This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on September 29, 2016. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
All right. Well, I'll repeat myself again to welcome everyone that the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, September 29, 2016, will now come to order. Before we begin on our agenda items, I will turn to the Vice Chairman to make a motion regarding late submitted documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of the following documents. Agenda document number 16-45-B, draft B of Advisory Opinion 2016-10. Agenda document number 16-50-A, Internet Communications Disclaimers, Draft A. Agenda document number 16-48-A, Proposal to Attack Scam PACs. Agenda document number 16-49-A, Revised Proposal to Launch Rulemaking to Ensure that the U.S. Political Spending is Free from Foreign Influence. Agenda document number 16-43-B, Technological Modernization in PRM. Agenda document number 16-43C, Technological Modernization in PRM. This is a proposed amendment to Technological Modernization MPM submitted by Commissioner Goodman.
Is there any discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Madam Secretary, that motion carries by a vote of 6-0. Before we turn to the agenda items, I also want to recognize Lisa Stevenson on the dais. She was recently named by the Commission to be the acting general counsel for the Commission. She's been serving as the deputy general counsel since 2012. And before that, she was a partner at the law firm of Zuckerman Spader. She's a proud graduate of both the University of Michigan Law School as well as Amherst College, where she got her bachelor's degree. And we just want to thank her for her willingness to step forward and serve in this capacity at this time. We appreciate the leadership and fine work that you've done up to this point. And like I said, very much appreciate that you've been willing to step forward and extend your leadership wings even further in this capacity as acting general counsel. So thank you very much. The first item on the agenda that's listed is the advisory opinion 2016-10, Caroline Goodson Parker. We are going to skip that one for right now. There is a draft that's been circulated and is being printed. And so we will wait for that to be circulated here at the dais, and we'll probably pick that up after we consider the first couple of items on the agenda. So let's turn to item two for right now, which is Reg 2013-01, Draft Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Technological Modernization. We have Ms. Jessica Selenkoff from the Office of General Counsel to give a presentation. And good morning, and when you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Peterson, and good morning, Commissioners. The Commission has before it three draft notices of proposed rulemaking on technological modernization. These drafts all propose revisions to over 100 Commission regulations to eliminate references to outdated technology, such as telegrams, to modernize regulations concerning the receipt, deposit, forwarding, and disbursement of funds to address electronic financial transactions, and to update regulatory language in light of current and emerging computer and internet technology for communications and record keeping. These technology issues are increasingly coming before the Commission. The drafts themselves discuss a number of advisory opinions, court cases, and academic and popular writing on technology and campaigns since the Commission published the advance notice of proposed rulemaking on this rulemaking in 2013. Since last discussing a draft of this rulemaking, the Commission has issued 5 advisory opinions and has 2 pending, interpreting regulations applied to online payment processing, mobile apps, and internet communications. And since last considered, the Commission has made public over 25 closed enforcement matters concerning the application of regulations to a variety of electronic transactions, records, and communications, including the application of disclaimer requirements on websites, emails, and social media activity, the application of the volunteer internet exceptions, and the determination of electronic receipts. As the Commission considers and continues to improve the clarity of its regulations in light of current and emerging technology, we're available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for that presentation, Ms. Selenkoff. And if I recall, we considered this late last year. And if I remember correctly, it was on the verge of when the newest Star Wars movie was going to be released. And I recall that you even had a few Star Wars-related asides that you included. So it's sad that I think that we're now picking this up when another sequel is just around the corner. So, but fortunately, we didn't have to wait until that happened to pick this up and consider this before the commission.
A prequel, not a sequel, Mr.
What's that?
Chairman.
I guess that's right. That's true. Are there any questions or any statements that that any commissioners have on this matter? Let me just state at the outset, I want to thank my colleagues for their efforts to put something together that I think we'll be able to agree upon. As Ms. Selenkoff pointed out, the regulations that we have on the books contemplated a very different world in terms of how money was raised and spent and how communications were disseminated than the one that we find ourselves in right now. It is kind of amusing to go back and see references to telegrams, audio tapes, microfilm, things that have quickly become outdated. And it's also interesting just to consider the most recent update that dealt with technology, the internet rule from 10 years ago. I mean, the rage at that point was blogs. You know, how are we going to regulate blogs? And blogs are still relevant, but perhaps less so. Now we're talking about mobile apps and how do our rules interact and account for those? Cutting personal checks. I don't remember the last time I ordered a new checkbook because everything I do now is predominantly online electronic transfers, and certainly the impact that technology has had on us and our personal lives is certainly extended to the political realm. And so it's more than overdue for the commission to update its regulations to account for those technological advancements. And so I thank the Office of General Counsel, Ms. Selenkoff, Mr. Noti, for all the efforts that took place down in the Office of General Counsel to prepare this document. And like I said, I appreciate all the efforts from all the offices to try to put together a document that we can feel comfortable with to submit for the commission for the public to comment upon. I would hope that we can successfully conclude this rulemaking in the not so distant future, and very much look forward to seeing how we can get our reg books a little bit more in the 21st century. So, look forward to voting affirmatively for this when a motion is made. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to compliment you on your persistence in trying to get this done and bring it to the table to help commissioners get to a place where we hopefully can all agree and move forward and make some productive, you know, it's not very sexy, but it's productive and useful and well worth doing. And I think it was a very wise strategy to not try and put things in here that, you know, loaded up with things that were going to raise hackles on one side of the table or the other, but rather to make it sort of a mainline document on things that we could all agree on. And it's nice to find things to agree on. So my compliments to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? Do we have a motion? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd also like to thank you for your leadership on this issue. You and your office, and in particular Theo Lutz, have worked really hard to get this here to us today. So thank you. I move approval of agenda document number 16-43-B, otherwise known as draft C.
We have a motion on the table. Is there any discussion? Commissioner Goodman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that this was intended to cause hackles, but I do have an amendment to offer to the motion of this tech modernization NPRM. The language that I'm proposing is well known to the commission. It was in an earlier draft of this technological modernization NPRM that was circulated and considered by all offices about a little over 2 months ago. It didn't make the final cut, but it's important to me, and I want to propose it as an amendment to this at the table, because when we look at the impact of new technologies, they have had a particularly profound impact on the press and media and the way in which they publish and disseminate news and commentary. So it has been pointed out to me previously that our press exemption regulation does not identify books among the media of publication. And that raises a question of both bringing us, updating us for a centuries-old medium, but also now we have electronic books and audio books. And it's unclear when you look at our regulation whether Kindle readers and the books you read on Kindle are exempt or not. Likewise, there has been some disagreement over the extent to which this agency will protect filmmakers, films and streaming videos on the Internet. And so that raises the question of whether Netflix and Amazon Prime and those types of streaming services are going to be protected in the same way as broadcast or cable television, for example, now that people get their content through different media. And these are new technological innovations. The commission had occasion a few years ago to answer an advisory opinion request from XM Radio on whether satellite radio would be included. Satellite, while broadcast and cable are referenced as technologies in our press exemption regulation, satellite is not. And then, of course, we recently had occasion to discuss applications in an advisory opinion from a group called Ethique. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Ethique was the provider of a news clipping service, essentially, and I have one on my Droid. And you can go through and you can click all the issues that interest you, and you can receive a tailored news clipping service that they provide and they curate for you. So in other areas of the tech modernization NPRM, we are including applications. I thought it might be important to update that to recognize that the New Media Press publication often publishes through applications as well. Now, this proposal is not intended to make new law. It is intended to clarify the existing law, because applications we recognized under the press exemption in the Ethique advisory opinion. Films and videos have been recognized as entitled to the press exemption in the Citizens United advisory opinion, the Showtime advisory opinion, streaming video online in the Maloth advisory opinion. So by recognizing moving pictures or motion pictures in our reg, we're clarifying existing law. Satellite radio, this proposal adds to broadcast and cable. Satellite, and since it recognizes currently television but doesn't mention radio, why not mention satellite television and satellite radio in our regulation? Important technological update. And finally, books. As I mentioned, there's centuries-old technology, but now we have electronic books. And the Supreme Court has recognized that books and moving pictures are fully entitled to the press protections of the First Amendment. Not just the First Amendment protections, but they are included in the press clause. So these are well-settled legal principles, and here is a perfect and opportune time to update our press exemption. But I must say it's not always clear, given some of the disputes that and votes that we've had, about whether certain things are indeed exempt. So it's important to say whether or not this item, entitled Jeb, America's Next Bush, is entitled to the press exemption or not. I have tabbed it for every reference to his potential presidential campaign. And I can say this is a very unflattering view of the former governor of Florida, written by a journalist in Florida. And the entire last chapter is focused on what type of presidential candidate and campaign he might be, what type of presidential candidate and president he might be, and editorializes that he would be a bad president given this journalist's experience with him in Florida. So I think we ought to clarify in our regulations whether this publication is exempt from our regulation. It was published in the year 2007 by Penguin Books. I believe that this book is firmly exempt from our regulations, and we ought to say so in our regulatory press exemption. There are other books. Here's one on Rudy that's not very flattering about Rudy, published in the year 2000. And here's one of my favorites that I bought in the gift shop next door. This is called Hillary Rodham Clinton Presidential Playset. And this one's pretty neat because what you can do with this book is it's oriented to children. And see, you can take Hillary Clinton and pop her out here. And you can open up the Oval Office picture, and you can put Hillary Clinton right there in the Oval Office next to a picture of Bill and Hillary. Now, that looks like express advocacy to me when I do that. I think this book is exempt from our regulation under the press exemption. But it's unclear right now, given some votes of this commission and a regulation that doesn't mention books. So, for all these reasons, I propose an amendment. My amendment is set forth in agenda document number 16-43C. And in the two places where our press exemption is mentioned in the regulations, it would add the phrases satellite and radio, internet-enabled applications to recognize the ethic advisory opinion, motion pictures to recognize those advisory opinions that I've just mentioned, and books. And that's all that it adds into our press exemptions: satellite radio, internet-enabled applications, motion pictures, and books. Once those are added in the regulation, the commission has a formula or a methodology for deciding whether a certain book or whether a certain motion picture is exempt under the Reader's Digest and Phillips publishing constructs. So this doesn't necessarily expand the press exemption. It merely recognizes existing media and updates them to recognize technological updates. So at this time, I will move agenda document number 16-43C as an amendment to the main motion.
Is there any discussion on that motion? If none, Commissioner Weintraub?
I'm just going to say one sentence, and that is we worked very hard to come up with a consensus document. There were other things. I didn't come to the table prepared to make motions on the things that I ended up leaving out that I would have liked to put in, because I'm going to support the consensus document. That's what I'm going to do.
Commissioner Ravel.
A similar response, but not exactly. I mean, as you indicated, this issue has been pending for about a year. And these additions that Commissioner Goodman is speaking of just arrived today. And so there's really not sufficient time, in my view, to consider them. And I think we should sever the amendment and vote on the original document. And then we can have another discussion, if we want, on the amendment itself and whether or not to do something with respect to the document. But to hold it up on newly arrived information today that none of us have had an opportunity to really review and think about, I think, is problematic for us. It's not conducive to thoughtful consideration of issues, despite the fact that we like the little White House playbook.
Yes.
Commissioner Goodman.
Chairman, there's nothing new about these proposals. For any commissioner who's been here for any period of time, let me ask you, is this book exempt or is it not, in your mind, Commissioner Ravel? Is it exempt under the press exemption or isn't it?
I don't think that that's the issue before us. The issue before us is what we're going to include in an NPRM, and I'm not here to be cross-examined by you.
Well,
I know that's your favorite MO, but that's not what's the purpose of this meeting in this.
Well, it
issue.
Is a purpose to deliberate, and so I'm trying to understand the true reason why you're opposing this. Because
I received this this morning at, well, it doesn't have the time, but this morning. And we've been discussing this issue and coming to a consensus on the document for a year.
Yes, except that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This language was circulated to all commissioners' offices 2 to 3 months ago. I'd ask the chair's office on when that draft was first circulated. But this language was in a draft, and every commissioner considered it. The reason it didn't make the final draft is not because people didn't have adequate time to consider it. The reason it didn't make the final draft was because, in response to this, your office inserted additional language into the NPRM that suggested that we regulate the production cost of all internet videos. The chair's office, trying to draw calm, trying to hold down the controversial issues, requested that I take this out of that draft. So
that's right.
This is not new. I just insist on accountability, and I want to vote on this issue.
And
but it was removed. So to say I'm going to vote against this today because I haven't had time to consider whether books are exempt under the press exemption falls flat, I think, as a reason for voting no. I think it's time to just say, either I agree that books are exempt from the press exemption or I don't. But you've had months to consider that issue.
I presume that you're just trying to utilize this argument for the Washington Examiner. But in fact, I had another proposal and you rejected it. And so this is a compromise. That's what we're here to vote on. And I'm more than willing to go forward on this issue without my proposal as well.
So substantively, then, you oppose addition of this amendment. It's not that you didn't have enough time to consider whether books or whether satellite radio is exempt from the press exemption. That's not the real reason you're voting no today, right?
I'm not engaging in a colloquy with you, Mr. Goodman.
Okay. I think the votes will speak for themselves, Mr. Chairman. If there are any other questions of commissioners, I'm happy to address them.
So we have a motion to amend the main motion that is set forward in agenda document number 16-43-C. I'll call the vote. All those
in favor. Wait a second.
Oh, sorry.
You're going to vote on the amendment?
Yes, this is voting on, the amendment proposed by Commissioner Goodman.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, that is set forth in agenda document number 16-43-C. So I'll call the votes on that. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
Nay.
No.
Madam Secretary, that motion fails by a vote of 3-3 with Commissioners Goodman, Hunter, and myself in favor, and Commissioners Ravel, Weintraub, and the Vice Chairman opposed. So we have a motion that was set forward with respect to agenda document 16-43-B, which we've been referring to as the compromise document. Is there any further discussion as to that main document?
Oh.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'd like to say, Ms. Ellenkoff, you've done a great job, as always, on these complicated things, and congratulations for getting us all together through all of this, working on this.
All right, we'll call the votes. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Madam Secretary, that motion carries by a vote of 6-0.
Okay.
Next item on the agenda, which is item 3, Reg 2011-02, Internet Communication Disclaimers. I'll turn it back over to Ms. Ellenkoff to discuss this one as well.
Thank you, Chair Peterson. The Commission has before it a draft Federal Register notice on a related matter. The advance notice of proposed rulemaking regarding Internet Communication Disclaimers, originally published in October 2011. In light of subsequent legal and technological developments, today's draft notice proposes to reopen the comment period and it sets a hearing. The draft invites comments addressing the ways that campaigns, political committees, voters, and others use the internet, particularly apps and emerging tech, to disseminate and receive electoral and campaign information. The draft seeks comments on possible technological limitations and opportunities for complying with the disclaimer requirements of the Act. If the Commission approves the draft, the Office of General Counsel will submit the draft for publication in the Federal Register, and we're available for any questions you might have.
Thank you for that presentation. I'll just state at the outset that this effort is somewhat of a piece with the technological modernization rulemaking that we're undertaking. As we mentioned, the means by which we're transacting financial business and communicating and consuming information has changed dramatically. And We've had a number of advisory opinions in recent years that I know that this body has considered regarding how do our internet disclaimers requirements, which contemplated very different communication medium. They were contemplating TV, radio, physical mail, newspapers. Those were the most common ways by which political communication was transmitted. And now, with online communications, and especially communications by mobile device, for those of us who have children who seemingly cannot go a few minutes without having some interaction with a screen, and if you were to take it away from them, it's as if you were depriving them of their oxygen. We know how much that has become the primary device by which we receive information, consume information, transmit it, conduct business, and how our disclaimer requirements interact with those the devices has given rise to some interesting questions. Some of those technologies have limits on the amount of space on a small phone that you can use, the number of characters that can be employed. And so what this is, this effort to reopen this comment period and have a hearing, this is an effort for the commission to gain more information. I think not only to ask the campaign world their experiences and to get information and legal analysis regarding how our regs, our regulations interact with these technologies, but I would also hope that we could get comments and reactions from the high-tech sector to find out what sorts of possibilities are out there to meet the requirements of the Act's disclaimer requirements while at the same time allowing our mobile devices and the online environment in general to continue to flourish as a means for again political fundraising, political communications, for the ability to gather information. And so again, this has been an effort that I commend my colleagues for being willing to reopen this and seeking additional information to see whether or not this might be something that would be amenable to a rulemaking. I think that if we could. If that were the ultimate result, I think that would be a great thing because kind of the piecemeal approach of advisory opinions can lead to some confusion or maybe a lack of coherence and maybe difficult for someone to really know exactly what is or is not required with respect to disclaimers and how they're going to apply to online technologies. So I really look forward to hearing from, again, everybody in the campaign world and the technology sector to find out what sort of solutions are out there that we may not be aware of and what sort of tweaks that we might be able to make to our regulations to accommodate those technologies so that we can meet the purposes of our law while at the same time accommodating the latest technological advancements. So. Commissioner Weintraub.
Just want to compliment you yet again, Mr. Chairman, for pursuing this issue, which I agree is a really interesting one. And I think I'm hoping we're going to get a lot of good comments, and I think it could be a really interesting hearing. I just have a question. There are blanks for the dates. Do we need to – maybe that's a question for counsel. Do we need to fill in the dates?
We believe we could do that as a technical and conforming amendment after approval.
Super.
And the only date that will need to be filled in is the date of the hearing.
Yes. Okay. That was the one I was interested in. I want to make sure I clear my calendar.
Is there any other further discussion on this matter? If none, do we have a motion? Commissioner Hunter?
I move approval of agenda document number 16-50-A.
We have a motion on the table. Is there any discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Madam Secretary, that motion carries by a vote of 6-0. If we could just pause for just 1 second. Do we have draft C in the Parker advisory opinion ready to circulate yet?
I have not seen it come around.
Okay.
Yet, no.
We'll just... Someone raise their hand, flag me down when that's ready for consideration. But until that time, we'll just move on to the next item. I'll point out that item 4, the proposed amendments to Directive 52, that matter is being held and will be considered at the next open meeting. Item 5, which is promoting voluntary compliance, we discussed this at the last open meeting. And Commissioner Hunter, is there anything that you wanted to add on?
Sure. Just briefly, I heard from my colleagues, I believe it was yesterday, with some suggested edits to the document, and I appreciate their feedback. We also just heard from the Office of General Counsel, so my office is working with the Office of General Counsel to add a little bit more information, and we hope to have something finalized hopefully by the end of today or tomorrow in order to submit it as an op-ed in hopefully a national newspaper. So thank you to everybody, and hopefully we can come up with something that everybody can agree to very soon.
Okay. We will continue plugging away on that and appreciate your efforts to make that possible. We'll now turn to item number 6 on our agenda, which is Presidential Public Financing Legislative Recommendations. The information, the agenda document is number 16-46-A, which was submitted by Commissioner Ravel. And I will
thank
turn
you,
it
Mr.
over to
Chairman.
You.
Thank you. I've put this recommendation on the agenda for discussion purposes only, because I understand we have a normal process for legislative recommendations, and it seems to me that this would not, you know, go outside that normal process, but that because the issue of public financing in the presidential program we know is so outdated, and in this particular election has been a really good example of that, since none of the major candidates are utilizing this, nor have they for some time. It seems to me that it's appropriate for us to think about this issue, and I'm open to any other suggestions or thoughts about this. But I'm very interested in us pursuing this when the time comes for our legislative recommendations. I've done a little background, or actually my staff, of course, has done a little background on this. And every single year from 1977 until 2005, the Commission has made recommendations to Congress about the public financing program, and I really do think that it's worth doing so again. As I said, it's out of date, and part of the reason that it's out of date is for some of the reasons that I've described in the memo, but also because, as we have just been talking about technology, things have changed significantly in the way people are able to obtain campaign contributions. And the use of technology for getting lots of small donors is really different now than it was at the time that this program was contemplated. And yet the important purposes of the voluntary public financing remain. And I just want to quote to you, I mean, this is a program that we are invested with the role of administering, and the Supreme Court has said that the purposes of this financing program are to facilitate and enlarge public discussion and participation in the electoral process, goals vital to a self-governing people, eliminate the improper influence of large private contributions, and relieve major party presidential candidates from the rigors of soliciting private contributions. As we know, it encourages people, more people, to participate in the political process, and it also provides incentives for candidates to reach out to a much broader base of donors in order to receive support. So I have already made the recommendations about the specific items, and if there's any questions about it, I'm happy to answer them, but this is really just for either notification or discussion. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on that? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just full of compliments today. I want to compliment my colleague on putting together this nice package. I am particularly I think one of the best aspects of this is a really intriguing and innovative suggestion that came from a suggestion from Tony Corrado, Michael Melbin, Tom Mann, and Norm Ornstein about permitting national parties to make unlimited coordinated expenditures with participating candidates, provided that the parties use funds raised from a pool of contributions of from small donors, small donations. And it is a I think that is a great tool for both empowering political parties, something that some of my colleagues talk about a great deal as a goal of theirs, as well as encouraging parties to reach out more to small donors. I remember after BICRA passed, a lot of people said, oh my God, the parties are never going to be able to raise money under all these limits, and because they had real incentive under BICRA to do it, they ended up raising in the next cycle just as much money, if not more, by expanding their donor base and reaching out more to small donors. So this was a great incentive to the law became a great incentive to the parties to really do more outreach, and that helps to strengthen the parties because it gives them not only more donors, but it gives them more grassroots activists. So I think that is a particularly interesting idea and a smart one. And I look forward to further discussions on this.
All right. Is there any further discussion? Oh, Commissioner Rao.
Let me just add, I appreciate the compliment and the compliments to those four gentlemen who came up with this idea, because I, too, have always been concerned about the problems that the parties have discussed in the age of independent expenditures. And that's one of the main reasons for this public financing program, and to kind of counterbalance that. And it's more important now than it ever was. And it's important not only for individual candidates, but for the parties as well. Also, and I know there's been criticism in the press apparently about this being a big giveaway, but actually we have to remember that the money for this comes from individuals who voluntarily contribute this money. It is not tax money, really. It is a voluntary contribution. In fact, on our website, right now, when we speak of this program, we talk about, let's see if I can find this, what it says about it. That Congress left the single most important decision to you, the taxpayer. You decide whether you want $3 of your tax to be used for the presidential public funding program. So it's hardly a giveaway of public funds.
Is there any other further discussion on this matter? All right. Well, it's an important reminder that process is just right around the corner when we assemble our legislative recommendations. Certainly look forward to working with all our colleagues and putting that package together. We'll turn now to, well, we just had circulated the most recent draft in the Parker AO, and so I think we all know what's in the draft, so why don't we go ahead and consider that. So we'll turn back to item number one on our agenda, which is Draft Advisory Opinion 2016-10, Caroline Goodson Parker. We have a series of drafts that we now have to consider. And we have Esther Jory from the Office of General Counsel to give a presentation. And good morning to you. When you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman Peterson. Do we have a late submitted document?
Oh, yes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, I move to consider AO 2016-10 Parker Draft C as a late submitted document.
We have a motion on the table. All those in favor, indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Madam Secretary, that motion carries by a vote of 6-0.
Thank you, Chairman Peterson, and good morning, Commissioners. Before you are agenda documents 16-45-A, 16-45-B, and 16-45-C, draft advisory opinions responding to a request from Caroline Goodson Parker. Ms. Parker is a U.S. citizen living in Canada who plans to solicit friends and family by email or text message for contributions or donations to state and local party committees. The requester asks several questions regarding her proposed solicitations. All three drafts conclude that Ms. Parker may solicit contributions and donations to state and local party committees as described in her request, and that she may notify state and local party committees about her activity. The drafts further conclude that the Act and Commission regulations require Ms. Parker, in some instances, to inquire into the citizenship status of persons whom she plans to solicit, but the drafts disagree as to what circumstances would require her to do so. Finally, the three drafts conclude that Ms. Parker is not obligated to warn individuals whom she solicits about the prohibition on soliciting foreign nationals. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the drafts. Thank you. I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
For that presentation, do we have any discussion on these drafts? Commissioner Weintraub?
I think the only controversial part of any of this, and props to Ms. Parker for coming up with creative ideas for how to, you know, stir things up at the grassroots and maybe get some more money to grassroots activity in state and local parties. I think the only disagreement at all on any of this goes to at what point one would need to at least put out a warning in one solicitation that foreign nationals aren't allowed to give. And I think my answer to that is it depends on who you're soliciting and whether there's some rational basis to believe that the solicitation might end up in the hands of foreign nationals. And I think, by the way, that putting in one sentence that says, by the way, foreign nationals are not allowed to give in U.S. elections, would not be terribly onerous and would be a boon to the recipients who, you know, we're talking about small organizations. We have seen on many occasions how they sometimes get tripped up on their compliance activities. And I would hate to see this effort to do good for local party organizations to end up embroiling them in compliance headache because they end up with a lot of innocent, you know, people who are trying to help, not realizing they're not allowed to do it, but it ends up with foreign money in their coffers, and they may or may not realize that they're supposed to do something about that or that it's even there. And I think there's two ways that could play out. If she's soliciting people that are living in another country, but she knows at least at one time, you know, when she last knew them, they were U.S. citizens, or when she last talked to them, but years have gone by and they're now living in a foreign country, it seems to me there's a real possibility that they could have changed their citizenship since they're living in a foreign country for some period of time. The flip side, and this is why I may be the only one that has concerns about this, but I have some concerns about the answer to question three. If she is soliciting people that she knows in the expat community in Canada or anywhere else, the odds are good that they know a lot of other people who are Canadians. So if she is sending them something and saying, pass it on, and they just sort of send it out to everybody they know on their Facebook page or on their in their Twitter feed or on their, you know, through their address book, through email, it's likely that they're going to know a lot of people who are Canadian citizens. So I think it would be actually a real boon to all concerned to just include that one sentence. And it's, you know, we're trying to do this on an expedited basis. She's not technically entitled to the expedited treatment, but, you know, we try to accommodate that when we're close to the election, and I appreciate that. Sitting here today, I'm not sure that I agree that it's not providing substantial assistance in the solicitation of a foreign national to send the text of a solicitation out to somebody who likely has foreign nationals in their social media groups and just draft it up and say, here, pass this on, and make it easy for them to just cut and paste or forward it on. So I'm not willing, even in draft C, to vote for answer three, which, you know, I'm hoping that we can divide up the motion so that I can support the rest of draft C. And I don't know whether we're going to have a vote on the original draft that I guess was draft A, but I was prepared to support draft A other than this answer to question three for that reason. But I do think that this is overall, you know, it's a nice, friendly, grassroots kind of idea, grassroots promoting kind of idea, and I'll throw out compliments to Ms. Parker, too, because I'm just in that kind of mood today for coming up with it.
It's kind of diminishing the compliment that you gave me.
I'm sorry. No, I have lots of good feeling for very many people.
Okay.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
The thing is, if one of us, each one of us doesn't get one, we're really going to feel bad. So, I mean, instead of thinking,
my compliments to you
do
Mr.
your
Vice
best.
Chairman. I'm not sure what for yet, but I'm sure I'll come up with them.
Whatever it is, I'll take it. I join the Commissioner Weintraub on question three, answer to question three. So I would support A and the first two parts of C.
Commissioner Rabel.
Yes, I think we should do a motion first on A,
okay.
But which I support, but I will also support C.
Okay. Commissioner Goodman.
I've been trying to understand. These are nuanced distinctions between A and B and C, and the obligation that is imposed on somebody who wants to just, in a grassroots way, send out emails to people that they know. By the way, I think this is fairly uncommon. Most people, I think, send out more mass emails, you know, to broad list, or they post information on a Facebook page for all comers, or there are ways to go viral. And, you know, Howard Dean sort of pioneered the, I'll send out the giving applications, you know, software system to a whole bunch of people and ask them to metastasize it, you know, to go viral with it and send it out to their networks. And he was very successful in having people go do that. And if at every step of the way Howard Dean would be held accountable, or his campaign would have been accountable for who they might solicit, because he didn't say, oh, and you've got to warn the other people. I don't know how these viral campaigns work, especially when it goes down to the second tier. So I guess I'm trying to understand, is your concern in between B and A, is it the fact that she knows these people specifically? So if she were to broadcast it very widely and indiscriminately across social media pages and email lists, she'd be okay. It's only because she is emailing specific people she knows, and she knows where they reside. Is that the key distinction between these? Is that the rule of draft A? Is that what distinguishes this from all that mass emailing and mass solicitation that goes on the internet?
Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, I'll defer to counsel to explain the differences between the various drafts, which have been coming very quickly, and I wouldn't want to get it wrong. But for myself, I mean, I'll draw, you know, the distinction between if she has a some email group or whatever of, you know, alumni of the college that she attended in the United States, I would think that there would be, one would not, I mean, yeah, there might be a few foreign nationals who attended school with her, but that's, for the most part, not going to be a big part of that list. So I wouldn't think that you would need to have any kind of particular
finding as to each individual on that list.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or even to just sort of send out a blast email to, if she had access to, you know, some social media group that included all of the alumni of her
college in the United States, I would think there would be no obligation to say, oh, and if you happen to be a foreign national, you can't give, because the vast majority of those people are going to be U.S. citizens. It's only because a couple of her networks include either expats living in a foreign country who almost certainly have a lot of people within their networks who are you know, residents of that foreign country, citizens of that foreign country, and people who've been living for a long time, even though they started out as U.S. citizens, people who've been living for a long time in a foreign country and may well have changed their citizenship over the years. I think those facts suggest that there's a higher duty to warn people. And as I said, I think it's a boon to the recipients as well.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the distinction. I don't necessarily agree that, but at least I appreciate the rationale behind it, and that we're not opening this up to broad social media platform solicitation. That at least I understand that's our difference of opinion on this. I happen to believe that if someone I know has been a U.S. citizen and has moved abroad and now has a foreign address, it doesn't automatically require me to go back and check to say, have you renounced your U.S. citizenship? I mean, I think that's really the only difference of opinion here. That I understand there are some different issues on number three, but you know, that would implicate a list of U.S. servicemen with residing in Afghanistan. I mean, I don't think any of them have renounced their citizenship. I'm just saying that if you're looking at pockets.
I think it's a fact-based.
I understand that. And I'm not
being. I think it's a fact-based determination. And, you know, I would agree that if we were sending it out.
To U.S. soldiers,
could assume they're U.S. citizens.
Okay. I just don't think that I should work with her presumption. Someone I know was a U.S. citizen just because they're living abroad. And we all know these people. I don't know a single one of them who has renounced their U.S. citizenship. And I think that I should have a policy that presumes that I now have to, in order to contact my friend in London, say, hey, I want to solicit you, but before I do, I got to get your passport, or I got to make sure you're still a U.S. citizen. So, but reasonable minds can disagree on that level of knowledge, and I just wanted to be sure of the rationale that we were disagreeing about. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll just I was comfortable with the answer in draft B, and I think since there's going to be a motion on draft A, I think that if we have a motion on draft B, I think that would be appropriate as well. I don't disagree with Commissioner Weintraub that asking for an additional, you know, that it doesn't place much of an additional burden to notify the person that, hey, by the way, the foreign national ban is, you know, state what the particulars are of it according to our law. What gave me a little more comfort in this particular case is having it be someone that you've known and knew to be a United States citizen, and you're not aware of any facts. One thing in draft B is that we include a caveat saying that if you're aware of any other information that would indicate to you that this person may no longer be a United States citizen, then you would have that obligation. So, you know, if they posted on their, you know, if someone living in Canada, they post on their Facebook that how happy they were that they just cast a vote for the prime minister or something. I think that would certainly qualify as a changed circumstance that would lead a reasonable person to want to inquire whether or not you've changed your citizenship. And also, I think that since the individual making the solicitation, they're not the last line of defense to ensure that there's not a violation of the foreign national ban. If a state or local party were to receive a check and that check indicated, or the address was from a foreign country, they would then have an obligation to inquire to ensure that the citizenship status of the person who was making the payment. So, for those reasons, I was comfortable with the analysis and the answer in draft B as to that question, but I think on the whole we're agreeing on the vast majority of these things, and I think that's good that we can answer as much of this request as possible. And so, at the appropriate time, I'll be happy to support draft B, and knowing that will fail, I will then be voting in favor of draft C.
Commissioner Goodman? I would just comment in MER 6772, Obama for America. That was the position taken by the commission, that although the individual was alleged to have disseminated the Obama.com URL on international websites, the Obama campaign ultimately had a screen, and they exercised due diligence, and so the commission did not pursue an unlawful solicitation against the person who operated Obama.com, and the commission found that the Obama committee had adequate screens and indeed made some refunds and exercised its due diligence properly. So that screen worked in that case.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that was the right call in that case. I would draw the distinction, though, between the sophistication of the compliance operation of a presidential campaign and of a local party committee. You know, they're just not going to be staffed up in the same way and have the same. You know this to be true, Commissioner.
We have these debates in the enforcement meetings about the sophistication of the recipient and how to handle those. So, yes, I understand the issue. Yes.
Do we have any further discussion? If not, let's turn to motions. I don't know who. Why don't we just go in order if someone would like to make a motion with respect to draft A. Mr. Vice Chair.
I move to approve AO 16-10 Parker draft A.
I know draft A, but draft A still has the answer on question three that I disagree with and that I think, okay. Mr. Vice Chairman, you said you did too.
Well, why don't we do it? So, I agree with it, so why don't we
do
that one first and then separate them out or something?
Could we do it?
Oh.
Question by question. I mean, not question by question, but do one, two, and four, and then do three.
That's fine with me.
Okay. So just to make sure, we'll do one, two, and four on draft A,
right.
Then do question three on draft A.
Right.
Then we'll go to draft B,
right.
And then draft C. So just want to make sure we have it all sequenced.
Yes, but we're going to have to do the same thing on draft C.
Okay.
segregate out answer three. So, Mr. Vice Chairman, do you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead and make it.
Okay.
It's going to make us look like we're deadlocking a lot more than we actually really.
No, we actually do mostly agree on this, but I move. I move approval of draft A in AO 2016-10 with respect to the answers to questions 1, 2, and 4.
All right. We have that motion on the table. Any discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No.
I said aye.
Right. But do you want to take the next motion?
Yeah. Well, no.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Can we go to that?
So now I want to add.
I want to vote with the block.
Yeah.
I believe I'm voting no, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Madam Secretary, that motion fails by a vote of 3-3 with commissioners. Just to make sure, commissioners Ravel.
I voted aye, and then I want to add the next one to add in
question three. Okay. So to repeat what the vote count was, commissioners Ravel, Weintraub, and the vice chairman were in favor, and commissioners Goodman, Hunter, and myself were opposed.
Yeah, that's true. You know, Mr. Chairman, since question three is present in draft C, which I am going to support,
okay.
I'll forego making a separate motion with respect to this one.
Okay. Do we have a motion as to draft B? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. I move approval of agenda document number 16-45-B, also known as draft B.
Any discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
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 Madam Secretary, that motion fails by a vote of 3-3 with Commissioners Goodman, Hunter, and myself in favor, and Commissioners Ravel, Weintraub, and the Vice Chairman opposed. Now we can make a motion as to 1, 2, and 4 of draft C.
Right.
I don't know who.
I'll make the final motion.
Okay.
You want me to do that one again?
Sure. Good. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of answers 1, 2, and 4 in draft C with respect to advisory opinion 2016-10.
Any discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Madam Secretary, that motion carries by a vote of 6-0. And do we have a motion as to the last question?
Go ahead.
Commissioner Hunter.
I move approval of question 3 in agenda document number 16-45-C.
Is there any discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
Nay.
Madam Secretary, that motion carries by a vote of 4-2, with Commissioners Ravel, Goodman, Hunter, and myself in favor, and Commissioners Weintraub and the Vice Chairman opposed. Thank you, Ms. Jory, for all of your efforts on this draft.
Yes.
We'll now skip back to item 7 on our agenda, which is a proposal to attack scam PACs. There was a memo submitted by Commissioner Weintraub, set forth in agenda document number 16-48-A. I'll turn it over to Commissioner Weintraub.
And I just want to clarify that it was submitted by Commissioner Weintraub and Commissioner Rep.
Oh, I apologize. So,
quite all right.
I want to make
Thank
sure
you.
That credit is given where it's due.
This is a subject that I've been increasingly riled up about. It just really makes me mad. We're seeing this in increasing numbers, these PACs that are out there that solicit people's money, and they use candidates' name, and they suggest they're going to be spending the money on behalf of the candidate, and somehow or other the money never gets to the candidate, it never gets out into advertising, but a lot of money ends up in the pockets of vendors who often are associated closely and sometimes are the same people as the folks who organized the PAC in the first place. And, you know, we see this in the charity context also, but we don't have jurisdiction over that. And I guess it's not surprising that we're starting to see it in increasing numbers also in the political arena. And it mostly targets people who are small donors, who aren't going to have the resources or the time to spend a lot of effort trying to figure out, you know, what this particular PAC is doing or who they're supporting. They know who they purport to be supporting, but they may not have the means or the time to figure out whether these are really legitimate operations or not. You know, the big donors have advisors, and they have, you know, they can pretty much take care of themselves. There was an interesting article about the actor Daniel Craig getting taken in by one of these scam packs, but that's, I think, not the normal victim. The normal victim is somebody who is, you know, sitting at home and gets something either in the mail or online and seems to be supporting a cause that they care about, and they say, you know, I'm going to give my $25. And they're trying to exercise their First Amendment rights, and they're being thwarted. And the candidate that they are hoping to support is also being thwarted, and that money is being diverted. And we sometimes have gotten complaints from candidates saying, hey, there's somebody out there using my name to raise money, and I'm not getting any of it. There ought to be a law against that. And I agree, there ought to be a law against that. And I've been thinking a lot about this and whether there is really something that we can do about it, because I think we've all expressed some frustration with this when it comes up in the enforcement context, and we've acknowledged that the laws are not what we would hope they would be to protect against this. And we have from time to time made legislative recommendations to Congress, and I hope that when we consider our package this year, we will also consider doing that this year. I think we need to go beyond just urging that the literal anti-fraud provisions of the Act be expanded to cover this, but we also have to look at expanding personal use and anti-self-dealing provisions, because that's where the incentive is for people to do this. I mean, they're just ripping people off, and it makes me mad, and I want to do something about it. And I think that one thing that we can do is try to require, in addition to asking Congress for help, I think there are things that we could do here to improve the way we format our information so that it's easier for people to go to our website and figure out, for example, how much of a PAC's spending is going for overhead and how much is actually going for activities to promote a candidate. I think it's become easier to confuse people in the era of super PACs because there are so many different groups out there that all claim to be acting on behalf of different candidates. And we just had a loss in the Pursuing America's Greatness case where the court said reverse the refusal to grant a preliminary injunction. But the issue was whether using the name of the candidate and the name of the PAC could be limited, and the court said no and said that we could do other things. The court said, here the FEC reasonably fears that voters might mistakenly believe an unauthorized committee's activities are actually approved by a candidate if the committee uses the candidate's name in its title. But there is a substantial likelihood that the particular regulation is not the least restrictive means to achieve the government's interest. For example, the FEC could require a large disclaimer at the top of the websites and social media pages of unauthorized committees that declares, this website is not Candidate Doe's official website. The Supreme Court regularly views such disclosure requirements as less restrictive alternatives to flat bans on speech. But the FEC rejected proposals to have stronger or larger disclaimers in place of the overall ban. Well, you know, some of us, we're not happy with that decision, and we thought that we should appeal it to the en banc court, and some of us weren't willing to do that. So I think since we're stuck with this decision, at least we ought to listen to what the court said and try and do something to improve our disclaimers, improve our disclosure. We could have special landing pages. We could look at the size of the fonts. We could look at plain English requirements, because right now the way the disclaimers are written, they make a lot of sense to campaign finance lawyers when they talk about authorized committees and unauthorized committees or authorized communications and unauthorized communications. But I'm not sure that, you know, somebody sitting in their home looking at their computer for 15 minutes in the evening and seeing a solicitation online and seeing that disclaimer is really going to understand necessarily what that means and what the relationships are and are not between the PACs and the candidates whose names they're fundraising off of. So I think we could do more, and I've put a bunch of suggestions in here, but I'm certainly open to hearing what else we could do. I think that if we had more information about, you know, overhead versus spending on candidate advocacy, it would give people the kind of information that they get from websites like Charity Navigator. You know, I'm not proposing that we would actually rate campaigns. I think that would not be our job. We shouldn't be doing that. But we could provide the raw data, which we're already collecting. I mean, this wouldn't require statutory change because we already have this information. It's just a question of whether we could present it in a way that would be more helpful to people. And I think, you know, we could open up a rulemaking and talk about that and get suggestions from people and maybe do some real good here to try and help people avoid getting ripped off, because that's really what it is. And it's, as I said, people are trying to exercise their First Amendment rights to give money to the candidates of their choice, or in some cases to give money to oppose the candidates that they don't choose. But their First Amendment rights are, in some sense, being taken advantage of and denied them by these fraudsters. And I think we should do everything that we can to try and stop that from happening. So I propose that we start a rulemaking to deal with this. I hope that we will I think we should also consider how we could reformat some of our disclosures as we move forward in our newly updated and user-friendly website that we have at beta.fec.gov. Everybody go look there and give us suggestions on how to make it better. And I hope that at the appropriate time we could also consider legislative recommendations on this important topic.
Thank you. Commissioner Rob.
Yeah, let me just add a couple things, and I echo what my colleague has just said. Ever since we had the Alan West case, where we were all very frustrated because of the solicitation that appeared to not have a sufficient disclaimer, although it had one, but to indicate that the money was actually not going to the candidate, but going to a separate PAC. I think I have been very, very concerned about this problem and concerned about the fact that we don't have adequate mechanisms to inform the public. And I know there's, you know, some difference of opinion on the commission about what our role is with regard to the voters and informing the voters, and which is why I'm so pleased about Commissioner Hunter's proposal to give information to the public about all of these issues in voting and what our rules are. But we do have obligations to protect the public. That's part of the reason why there are regulations and laws relating to improper personal use of campaign funds, and that's under our purview. We look at that issue all the time, and the whole reason is that people who are giving campaign funds are entitled to make certain that their funds are being used for the stated purposes. That's why they're giving them. And a lot of these people who are being defrauded in these matters are elderly, don't have sufficient information, and are truly being taken to the cleaners by some of these scam packs that have now arisen in much greater numbers during this campaign season than ever before. So it seems to me that the recommendations for providing greater information on our website, greater disclosure, would be an incredible service on behalf of the public that we should all be supporting. You know, with regard to the recommendations, legislative recommendations, I also support us asking Congress to look at this issue and give more authority to the FEC, no question, and we'll come to that. I don't disagree that this is a nuanced question, though. I mean, it really is. It's not particularly not so much the Allen West situation, but the situations where there's a determination about how much overhead is appropriate and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't think there's any question that it's complicated, but it seems to me that this is something that is important for us to embark on and to ask Congress to look at. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions or discussion? Commissioner Goodman?
I believe our new website is taking a stab at this, but it's doing it very brokenly and not in a very tailored way because we don't have all the mechanisms to sort out, given our purpose requirements, what things are for. So, for example, in the nonprofit world, if an organization sends out a solicitation letter, for decades, lawyers have advised, because on their 990s, they have to distinguish fundraising costs from mission costs. And so what most nonprofits do, if they send out a solicitation letter, and it's 10 pages long, and the solicitation with an insert return envelope is about 10% of the material, they regularly, and this is countenanced by the IRS, they count 90% of that direct mail piece at the total cost, printing, postage, to its mission, if it's educational, for example, and then they'll count 10% to fundraising for purposes of filling out their 990. I don't know that that's the rule we have to use. I'm just saying we don't require that type of sub-reporting the way the IRS does for charitable organizations. But I dare say that many of these organizations that people question will point to many emails that they send with a lot of advocacy in them, and then the ask for money is a link at the bottom. And so just to not to oppose your ideas, you have some good ideas, just to, I guess, say that right now our website is trying to show administrative costs for committees. And it's breaking things into categories as they're reported for our purposes without any ability to look at the sub-purposes underneath a direct mail piece, for example. So it's actually quite complicated, and I understand you understand that, and Commissioner Ravel just acknowledged that. So I guess this is not by way of throwing up my arms. I'm just saying the disclosure mechanisms we have in place are baroque, and obviously to...
Baroque or broke?
Baroque. No, yeah, no, you did a very good job, and the new website's pretty good. So it's trying to do more than we've historically done with these new graphs and percentage breakdowns and what have you, but it's nowhere near actually calculating the actual communicative elements of a direct mail piece, for example, versus the solicitation. And so, anyway, I think you raised some good ideas. They aren't lost on us, particularly after the Court of Appeals mentioned disclaimers could be perhaps enhanced. I think there may be some promise there. But anyway, not to understate the complexity of some of the disclosure remedies that you propose.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner Goodman. I never think that we should not launch an enterprise because we don't exactly know what the answer is going to be at the end. I think one thing that we could do as part of this effort is to reach out to people like the folks at Open Secret and at the Campaign Finance Institute, the people who regularly sort of dig into our data and look for more effective ways of displaying it. I know there have been suggestions in the past that maybe we ought to have standardized categories that people have to use when they are disclosing their disbursements, you know, so that it would be easier to try and figure it out. I completely get your point, and yes, of course, when people send out these solicitations, there is usually a lot of persuasive information in there. I don't think it would be a very effective solicitation if they didn't give people a reason to give their money. But I think we could, you know, I don't think we've ever looked at this in a focused way, how we could improve our disclosure towards this end. And it's an excellent time to be doing it as we are updating our website. One thing that struck me is I was looking at one particular website, and I can't remember what it was. I think it came up in the course of perhaps one of our enforcement matters. And yes, they had a perfectly fine disclaimer under all of our regulations at the bottom. But you would have to scroll way down to find it. It doesn't pop up when you first click on the page, and you know, as opposed to, say, the donate button, which does. So it would be easily overlooked. So I think that's the sort of thing we could look at. Maybe we should tell people they have to put the disclaimer at the top and not at the bottom. Maybe the font size needs to be improved, made larger. You know, I think there's a lot of perhaps even small fixes that might be helpful and that we could explore. I just want to point out that 2015 Politico study of FEC reports from the 2014 cycle found that a subset of 33 PACs, quote, spent only $3 million on ads and contributions to boost the long-shot candidates often touted in the appeals, compared to $39.5 million on operating expenses, including $6 million to firms owned or managed by the operatives who run the PACs. So, you know, we're talking about millions of dollars here. It's, you know, I suppose one could say, oh, but it's a multi-billion dollar election cycle. What's a few million dollars here and there? But it is a significant amount of money, and it hits the people who can least afford to be hit, and probably takes money away from some of these, you know, long shot candidates who are, you know, just trying to help us have a more vibrant democracy by you know, posing perhaps alternative views. So I'm encouraged by your comments. You know, yes, it might be hard, and we might not be able to do everything. But I think that if we started the process, we could probably get our lawyers drafting some very useful documents that would pose a lot of good questions. We could hold a hearing and invite people in to help us sort through some of these issues. We don't need a rulemaking in order to improve our disclosure, but I think it would be beneficial to try and at least seek some public guidance on that, seek some help from people who are basically in the same disclosure business, doing it different ways. And I think, you know, maybe this is something where we could actually do some good.
I'll just add my two cents. I thought, as I read through this, I thought this was a very constructive proposal. And as has been expressed, I think that there has been frustration about some of the MERS that we've encountered at maybe the limited tools that we have. And as both Commissioner Ravel and Commissioner Weintraub point out, that we do have limits on what we have within at our disposal, that there are many of the most difficult questions about how to some of the issues that you talk about, self-dealing, overhead percentage, those are very difficult questions and really would have to be worked out by Congress, which would be interesting. As she pointed out, we currently have a provision in the law that we enforce talking about that it's illegal to fraudulently misrepresent oneself as speaking on behalf of a candidate or on behalf of a party and then making a solicitation. And we can enforce that. The trickier question is, well, what about someone who doesn't represent that they are acting on behalf of a candidate or a party, but they are representing that I'm supporting a particular candidate and then little to no none of the money that they then contribute that they then spend actually goes towards direct advocacy. How you draw those lines are really tricky lines, and I think that those would have to be drawn by Congress. But I think that you also raise questions that whether our disclaimer requirements, which we do have control over and do have authority to amend or modify consistent with the statute, are those adequate to protect against efforts to mislead? And it's not only just efforts to mislead, and you were just even talking about sometimes there can be unintentional confusion where just the presentation might lead one to think that they're speaking on behalf of a candidate when they're not, and there's nothing intentional about it. But if, for example, the naming conventions in our rules are no longer going to be valid and candidate names are going to be maybe part of an unauthorized committee's name, then that creates the potential for unintentional confusion to go along with those who might be deliberately trying to mislead. And that does raise questions about what can we do with respect to disclaimers. And the court did point out some things that would be permissible, less restrictive means for getting at the same issue. And I definitely want to think about those as well. And with respect to the website, I view that as an effort to make a more informed consumer, just so that I think that would be helpful in instances where there is intent to mislead and to deceive, but also just for those who may get confused by all the committees that may be soliciting them, and in order to better sort out how they want to allocate dollars that they're going to contribute. So, I think this is a constructive proposal. I appreciate that you are interested to work with colleagues on this, and I'm not prepared to vote on it today, but this came in earlier this week, and we hadn't really delved into this the way we have maybe on some of the other issues. And so I'd like to think about some maybe ideas or any other responses I might have that we might be able to use to come up with a constructive, a proposal that we could all agree on. But like I said, I think this is a good first step in that process. And I think that while there's things that are out of our control, there are things that are within our control that we can do to help maybe solve this problem would be too strong of a word, but there are things that we can do to mitigate some of the harms that are being committed. Commissioner Weintraub.
Can I make a suggestion? Because I don't want to lose this, sort of positive vibe that I'm getting at the table here. If you're not prepared to vote on, officially launching a rulemaking at this point, could we agree to put together a working group of our staff, and it could include our EAs, if you want, but I think we should particularly reach out to our policy division and to some of our IT folks and try and put together a more developed set of proposals. Can we agree to at least take that step forward?
Yeah, I've got no problem with that. And I think that would be it would be useful to figure out what just to get a preliminary look to get a full extent of what is within our legal authority to do, and also to get a clearer idea of what technological solutions that, or aids to this problem that we might be able to marshal as well. So I think having a working group would be a very good idea.
I'm going to count that as a victory, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Are there any other discussions or? Okay, then we will. And we will take that, and we can discuss further about how we want to compose those and when we would like to meet and further that process.
Thank you. And I want to thank all of my colleagues for being so open and receptive to this idea.
We'll turn to item 7. Excuse me, that was item 7. Item 8, which is a revised proposal to launch rulemaking to ensure that U.S. political spending is free from foreign influence. This is put forward in a memo from Commissioner Weintraub, set forth in agenda document number 16-49-A. Now we'll turn to Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me first apologize to my colleagues for not getting this to you sooner. I made a commitment to myself after the last meeting that to not drop the ball on this and keep this moving forward, and it took me a little bit longer than I had hoped to try and come up with a more refined set of proposals. And I'm trying to move the ball forward here. I'm trying to find ways that we could find a path forward, because I really do think this is a serious issue. It's not a hypothetical issue. There are many companies that have heavy foreign involvement that are active in our economy. There are, as Professor Coates pointed out at the forum, a lot of industries in other countries have heavy state involvement in them, so that companies that look like private companies aren't entirely private companies in some foreign countries, and then when they get a stake in our companies, they have they sort of bring with them the involvement of foreign governments, which I think is an area of particular concern. I heard what the chairman said about his concern about the people who donate to SSFs, and so I'm taking that off the table. I am not proposing that we do anything that would affect any SSFs through this proposal. I'm only looking at the spending of corporate funds. And let me say at the outset, because there's been a little bit of misinformation generated on this topic, there is nothing in here about media entities. There was nothing in my original proposal about media entities, and I am happy to stipulate at the outset that nothing that comes out of this should affect media entities. That isn't the target of this in any way, shape, or form, and never was. I'm trying to focus this in on corporate spending, on money that is corporate treasury funds. You know, media entities don't make ECs and IEs. They don't get involved in the kinds of activities that I'm looking at here. So what I propose is, I've tried to organize this in a way that would make it easy to get people to get their hands around it. So there are. Four rulemaking proposals that have basically already been written. One of them, which was denominated a policy statement by my three colleagues at the last meeting, which could easily be put forward as a rulemaking proposal. And as I said last time, I just don't think that a safe harbor in a document that says the commission's not bound by it is a very safe harbor. So it would be in your interest, if you want to promote that, to actually do it through rulemaking. There are three different alternatives that were put on the table as far back as 2011 that Commissioner Walther has conveniently attached to a memo that he had at the last meeting. So, you know, we've got those all teed up with rulemaking language in them. And then there are a series of questions that I've asked, and I've tried to sort of frame these in the way that we normally put questions in NPRMs, which I would like to, you know, give to our counsel to draft a rulemaking document around these questions and those four proposals, and it might involve drafting some additional proposed regulatory text.
looking at issues like the percentage of foreign ownership overall, the percentage particularly of foreign government ownership, the board membership of the corporations, the type of corporations, and certain implementation measures. You know, whether we should do this through safe harbors, through certification measures. I put in one suggestion that I actually intended to put in last time, and it just got lost when we were preparing the last document, that was proposed by John Pudner at the forum that we held about just requiring people to verify credit card contributions by getting those CVV codes on the back, which is not currently required, but that would be just an additional way of trying to track contributions to individuals. So that's, I guess that's the one thing that goes towards individual contributions as opposed to corporate spending in this proposal. And if there is, you know, if people want to add things to this list, I'm happy to add things. If people want to subtract things from the list, I'm open to talking about that too. I would hope that there is something in here that we could agree on because, you know, we know, for example, and I refer people to the Boston Globe op-ed by Larry Tribe and Scott Greytack, that the Saudis have bought an interest in Uber, and Uber is spending money in, at least in local elections. Just yesterday, Congress actually overrode a presidential veto for the first time in 8 years in order to empower victims of 9/11 to sue the Saudis over, you know, and explore whether they were involved in 9/11. I don't think we want them playing in our elections. And it's not just the Saudis, they are, you know, the Chinese have a lot of interests. You know, they own the Waldorf Astoria, among other things. There are all sorts of foreign entities, up to and including foreign governments, that have investments in the United States and have the potential of affecting how the corporate money is spent. And I think when we focus on the corporate money, it really does, in some ways, crystallize the issue, because a manager of a domestic subsidiary who's figuring out how to spend the PAC dollars is not spending corporate money and does not have the same kind of fiduciary responsibility to the owners, to the foreign owners, that somebody spending the actual corporate resources would have, because those are the corporate resources. They belong to the corporation. They are obliged to do what is in the best interests of the owners of the corporation, which in some instances are foreign entities. So I really would hope, it's been such a nice day today so far. We've gotten so much agreement. I would hope that there is something here that we could agree to do.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. As you pointed out, we did get this, and I know that you pointed that out just, I think, late yesterday. And so, to be honest, I haven't even read it carefully.
It's really fascinating.
I can't wait. I'm not ready or interested right now in repeating all the same things we talked about last time, but I do just have one question, only because you brought it up just now. On page 3 of 5, you mentioned on the last paragraph, you mentioned that you want to put out for comment the 3 alternatives referenced by Vice Chair Walther's memorandum. I'm not sure about this, but I think that Steve's 3 proposals were related to SSFs and ownership within. I could be wrong, Steve. I don't know if you want to.
I don't think they were limited to that, but I'm happy to modify that to take out anything to do with SSFs.
Okay.
That's not, at this point, that is my intention, is to leave SSFs completely off the table.
Okay. Steve, is that what you had in mind too?
No, I'm not ready to do that yet.
Okay. I just wanted that one piece of clarification.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously support a great deal of this, and if we were actually going to vote today, I'd support it, and then I'd argue for a few more things. But
for what?
Then I'd argue for a few more things, but this is a nice beginning. But there's areas in addition to this, and I mentioned before, I still think we're pretty good at dividing a lot of this stuff, but it might not hurt to have a group or a law firm or somebody give us the ins and outs of the nuances of international corporate finance these days, including how money moves, bitcoins, everything else, so we can take these things into consideration when we go into this, because it's not like it used to be, and everybody had or fully owned Nevada corporation or something like that, and it's much different now. So as we go forward, I'd like to suggest that we consider something like that.
Another forum.
Another forum.
We could. I'm happy to work with you to organize.
Sure.
I just had a, in light of the fact that we got this a little bit later yesterday, I read it this morning when I got into work, and I think it was clear by the nature and the organization of the proposal that this is a genuine effort to try to find some common ground. I would like to, again, noodle through some of these a little bit more, see if there's some, if there might be some areas of agreement, see if there might be counterproposals, get a little bit of a better understanding of the nature of some of these proposals, go back and also get a clearer understanding. I can't remember all of the alternatives that were referenced in Commissioner Walters in his memo, but I, again, like the last proposal on scam packs, I thought that this was an effort to try to see if we can't narrow down the areas of disagreement, see if there aren't some a common core of ideas that we might find consensus on. And so I want to take a little bit of a closer look, and I'll probably be dropping by your office in the next week to ask a few more questions as well. And so
there for you.
All right. I look forward to that discussion, and let's see what
song with that title.
Do we have any other questions or comments on this particular proposal? But all right. If we don't, that brings us to the end of our agenda. The item that was calendared as item number 9, which is a proposed final audit report on FreedomWorks for America, that has been resolved offline. And so now I just turn to Mr. Palmer. Are there any management and administrative matters that need to be considered?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
All right. This meeting is adjourned.
You didn't want to renew that for the...
I put Hillary in the White House.